Okay, John chapter 11. John chapter 11 is lecture number 17. I'm going to try to get everything done in this course in about 27 or 28 lectures all total. So, we'll see how that goes. John chapter 11, the first 16 verses talk about the death of Lazarus. Take a look at John chapter 11. And the setting is given in verses 1 to 3. Look at verse 1 of John chapter 11. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. And it was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. The sisters therefore sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Okay, so remember now, Jesus had claimed to be God in Judea in the chapter earlier, and the Pharisees attempted to stone him, and he departed the region. Now, here he enters, here this situation, by the way, is occurring at Bethany. When you look at the map here, he was in Judea, around the Jerusalem area. Bethany is right next to it. Bethany is only 2 miles east of Jerusalem, okay? So it'd be very dangerous for Jesus to be in Bethany since it was so close. So now Lazarus was sick. He has two sisters, Mary and Martha, and they're going to call for Jesus to go to Bethany in hopes that he's going to be able to heal their sick and ailing brother Lazarus. By the way, Bethany, again, it's 2 miles to the east of Jerusalem. The Mount of Olives stands between the two cities. So you have the Mount of Olives where Jesus is going to touch down, where he's going to land when he returns to the planet Earth. It's right in between Bethany and Jerusalem. Now, Mary is identified as the one who had anointed Christ's feet. This occurred after Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. We're going to read about that when we get to John chapter 12. But he's writing it to these people, and he's saying, well, just in case you don't know who she is, she's the one that you heard about. Yeah, we just got started a couple minutes ago, Kurt. So he's saying, okay, remember the lady who anointed the feet of Jesus? Well, she's the sister. She's Mary, the sister of Lazarus. And he's going to mention that story in chapter 12 since it came at a later time. But remember, he's writing this about 90 AD, so he just wanted to remind the people who she was. And so the readers were familiar with Mary. This is also mentioned, I believe, in Luke chapter 10, verses 38 to 42. So they were familiar with Mary, but they were not familiar with Lazarus. You know, the Gospel of Luke was written before this Gospel, so they had heard of Mary, but they had not heard of Lazarus. And so that's why he explains who exactly Mary was and that she had anointed Christ's feet. By the way, with that situation, when Mary was anointing the feet of Christ, Martha was serving, and she was getting the meal ready, and she got mad. She told Jesus to tell Mary to get off her rear end and get in the kitchen and help her cook. And Jesus let her know that she chose the more important thing to do. And so our personal relationship with Jesus is more important than the worries and chores of this world. Okay? And keep that in mind. Verse 3, Mary and Martha's message to Jesus. First off, they call Jesus Lord, which means my master. It's kurios in the Greek, and but they refer to Jesus as their Lord. And it can mean Yahweh, the Yahweh of the Old Testament, or it can mean that you're just our important teacher. But whatever the case, Jesus loved Lazarus in a special way, it says here, and Lazarus is sick, and they send for Jesus. Now, verses 4 to 6, Jesus hesitates. Instead of going right there, he hesitates. Look at verse 4. This is Christ's response. But when Jesus heard it, he said, "The sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it." So Christ's response, he said, the purpose of Lazarus' sickness is not death, but the purpose is to bring glory to God. And so the Son of God here is going to be glorified through healing Lazarus, through raising Lazarus from the dead. Verse 5 talks about Jesus' love for this family. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So he has tremendous love for this family. Then in verse 6, instead of Jesus going there, they said, you know, you need to come out here, he's really sick. You would expect Jesus to head right on over there, but instead what happens, Jesus hesitates. So take a look at verse 6 of John chapter 11. When therefore he heard that he was sick, he stayed then 2 days longer in the place where he was. So Jesus stays 2 days longer. I think what Jesus is really, the reason why he stayed 2 days longer is because there's more glory goes to God when he raises the dead than when he heals the sick. Okay? He could have went right over there and healed this guy, but there'd be a lot more glory if he raised him from the dead. And right now, Jesus is getting ready. This is not long before, not long after he raises Lazarus from the dead, is the triumphal entry where he reveals himself as the Jewish Messiah, and then he's killed less than a week later. So Christ is trying to prove himself the Jewish Messiah, and there's more glory in raising the dead than healing the sick. So Jesus needed to show his mastery over death at this point in his ministry. Death, by the way, is man's greatest enemy. And so Jesus here, he's only following the Father's leading, not the leading of men. Man would say, hey, you got to get over there right now. But Jesus is following God's leading. He's going to do things according to God's timetable, not according to man's. And so Jesus doesn't always answer our requests at the exact moment we want him to. Sometimes we say, Jesus, yeah, I need to be healed now. And he doesn't heal us now. Sometimes he doesn't even heal us later. Sometimes he lets us die. But whatever God's will is, God knows what's best. There's a lot of information we don't have access to. I believe God does still heal as he did before, but it's always when he does heal us in accordance with his will. But Jesus doesn't always answer our request at the exact moment we want him to. They wanted him to come now. Jesus hesitated 2 more days before going there. Verses 7 and 8 talk about the apostles' fear of death. Look at verse 7. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." So after 2 days, he says, "Let's go back to Judea." Now, Jesus deciding to go to Judea, remember, these guys in Judea, the Jewish religious leaders, want to kill him. So, Bethany is in the region of Judea to the south here. It's only 2 miles away from Jerusalem, where his enemies are. And just to go into anywhere in Judea at all is dangerous. And so the apostles realize this, and the apostles remind Jesus that the Pharisees are seeking his life. They want to kill him. Verse 8. The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again?" So they make it real clear, Jesus, that, "Jesus, we think this is a bad decision. These guys want to kill you over there. This is the wrong time. Lazarus is sick, but just let him alone. I mean, you got to think about your own personal safety here." And you know, what it comes out to is that, you know, the apostles weren't being bad people, and our friends aren't bad people. But the fact remains, our friends will always give us reasons why not to do God's will. Okay? Our friends are always going to give us reasons why not to do God's will. "Oh, God called me to be a preacher." "Well, you're not the type of guy that should be preaching. You look more like the garbage man type of guy. So don't get your hopes up and this and that." But our friends are always giving us reasons why not to do God's will. However, if you know God's will, just do it. Men fear death. Jesus came to conquer it. Jesus said, "My Father wants me to go over there and raise this guy from the dead. I'm going to do it." So Christ's response in verses 9 and 10. Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world." But if anyone walks in the light, he stumbles because the... If anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. So Christ's response is that the Pharisees could not kill Jesus until it was the Father's time. When it was the Father's time, he would allow Jesus Christ to be killed. But until that time, the Pharisees could not kill Jesus. Jesus' outlook on the entire situation was supernatural. He was looking at it through God's eyes. He viewed things from God's perspective, not man. Jesus' view of the situation is that God's will is more important than personal safety. Yeah?
One thing I want to ask you about what you said on verse 8 about people give us reasons not to do God's will. In the book of Acts, when Paul said he was supposed to go to Jerusalem, mm-hmm. or go to Rome, there was a man who was a prophet who told him, no, if you go, you're going to be killed. Mm-hmm. Now, this guy was supposed to be a prophet of God. Well, it was a prophet of God. Mm-hmm. Paul recognized him as one. Now, why did he say that?
I don't think he... I'd have to read it again, but I don't think he said that he'd be killed. He said he'd be bound hand and foot, mm-hmm. and he was.
Yeah.
And it was a message from God. God wanted Paul to know that. Mm-hmm. But the way that Paul... And the, it seems God's will came about in the situation, so Caesar is true. It seems that God gave this man a message to forewarn Paul, but not necessarily to keep Paul from doing it, but just to let Paul know what was going to happen on the other end.
Even at that earlier, he said about Paul, I will show this man how much he must suffer.
Yeah, yep. And so, yeah, I think it was just Paul was forewarned, and then he could be all prayed up going into that situation. But Paul felt that God was telling it. He accepted it as a prophecy from God. But Paul took it as a warning, to a preparation of what was going to occur, not necessarily telling him to keep out of it. That's the same with the pre-trib, post-trib debate. The pre-tribber thinks that God is telling us about the tribulation period because he wants us to trust in him to keep us out of it. Whereas the post-tripper says, no, it's a warning about what's going to happen, but we're going to be there anyway. And so just because God forewarns us doesn't mean that he wants to keep us out of the situation. It might mean he wants us to go through it, but he's just letting us know. And that's the way Paul took it at that particular time. Yeah, Christian?
Just a quick clarification. Every time that you say that Jesus is following God's leading or the will of God, I think you're talking about God the Father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's plenty of times that Jesus will talk about God as the Father as his God. And that's perfectly right. I mean, there's even God the Father in Hebrews 1:8 calls Jesus God, says, "Thy throne, O God, is forever." But there's times that Jesus will talk about the Father as the God he submits to in that type of language. But that's something the Father and the Spirit would never do to him. But that's because when he took the role of the servant, when he became a man, as a man, he must submit to his God. At the same time, he is also has a divine nature, so he is also equal with God. But he does submit to the Father for this role. That's why he says, "I came down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." He even says the Father is greater than I, but there what he means is greater in function or role, because the Father never took on the weaknesses of humanity. Those passages all have to be brought together with the other passages where Christ is claiming equality with the Father and saying that the same worship and honor due the Father is also due to him.
Sometimes it can be pretty hard to confuse if there's some different context.
Yeah.
Talked about the different roles.
Well, that's where Paul said about Peter. When you read his work, 2 Peter chapter 3, unlearned, uneducated men, he says, they pull it out of context and they twist it to their own destruction. But what he's saying is you've got to really do your homework. And Paul, a lot of people say, well, I mean, Peter and the apostle, a lot of people say, well, they never went to Bible college. Well, God became a man and taught him day and night for 3.5 years. And if that's not Bible college, I don't know what that is. But but Jesus' response there is that the Pharisees could not kill him until it was the Father's time. And Jesus' outlook on the situation, he saw things from God's perspective, not man's. And his view is that God's will is more important for his life than personal safety. And Christ basically saying in these verses 9 and 10, we won't stumble as long as we walk in God's will. Now Jesus reveals that Lazarus is already dead in verses 11 to 15. Look at verse 11. This he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go that I may awaken him out of sleep. So Jesus said that Lazarus was asleep. Now when you look throughout the scriptures, when you look at how that's used, sleep, like in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13, it's talking about, you know, these people are dead, these people died. And so in the scriptures, often when they say someone's asleep, they're saying that someone's dead. Not always, but often. And that's what Jesus meant here, is that Lazarus is dead, but the disciples misunderstood. Verse 12, the disciples therefore said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, you will recover. In other words, hey, this is great. He's getting the rest that he needs, and now he can be on his way to recovery. So Jesus explains to them in verses 13 and 14 that Lazarus is dead. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he was speaking of literal sleep. Then Jesus therefore said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. So here, Jesus, you know, he's explaining to them that Lazarus is dead. He's actually, in fact, verse 15 as well, he said, Christ says, and I am glad for your sake that I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. He's saying, hey, the guy's dead, but I'm glad. Why? Because he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead, and it would increase the apostles' faith in Jesus much more than if Jesus had merely healed him. Especially for the fact that Lazarus is going to be dead 4 days by the time Jesus gets there. The response of Thomas is in verse 16.
He's saying if he would have been there, he would have still been there.
Well, he fully restored him when he rose him from the dead. So if he had chosen, he probably would have healed the guy if the guy hadn't died. But anyway, verse 16, Thomas therefore, who was called Didymus, Didymus simply means twin, so Thomas probably had a twin brother, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. So the response of Thomas, he's pessimistic, he felt that Jesus would die, but even though he's pessimistic, he is also courageous, he's willing to die with Jesus. Okay? So, doubting Thomas, we always think of him as doubting, but keep in mind he was also very courageous. He was willing to die with Jesus. When you look at this passage, by the way, you got many contrasting views of Lazarus' death. Lazarus' friends, they thought Lazarus' death was tragic. Jesus just saw it as another opportunity to display the power of God. Contrasting views concerning the trip to Judea. The trip to Judea, the apostles thought that meant Jesus' death, but for Jesus it meant raising Lazarus from the dead. Contrasting views about death, the apostles feared it, but Jesus conquered it. Contrasting views about God's will, the apostles taught personal safety comes first, Jesus taught that God's will comes first. And we need to follow Jesus' example, and not let others convince us not to do God's will, but we need to find God's will, put God's will first, and then we need to do it. Verses 17 to 27, Jesus reveals himself as the resurrection and the life. Look at verses 17 to 19, Jesus arrives. Verse 17, so when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. So now Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Now, Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off. And many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So many Jews are now comforting Martha and Mary here in verse 19. Verses 20 to 27, Jesus speaks with Martha. Martha goes out to meet Jesus in verse 20. Martha, therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him, but Mary still sat in the house. Now, when you look at verse 30, it says, now, Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha met him. Well, she didn't just run out of the house to meet him, she ran out of the village to meet him. I mean, she went out of the town to greet Jesus. But Mary, verses 28 and 29, a little later in this passage, Mary stayed in the house, okay? But Martha went out to meet Jesus. Martha expresses her feelings and her beliefs in verses 21 and 22. Martha therefore said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." So Martha expresses her feelings and beliefs. Jesus could have prevented Lazarus' death. She had a lot of confidence in Jesus. She figured that God would give Jesus whatever he asked for. She believes in Jesus' healing power, and she even seems to be hinting that she may believe in his resurrection power as well. Now Jesus responds to her in verse 23. Jesus said to her, "Your brother shall rise again." So he's saying, "Hey, Martha, your brother Lazarus is going to rise again." Her response is found in verse 24. Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And so she said her brother will rise on the judgment day. So she thought that Jesus was speaking about the final judgment. Now she was, we're going to find out Martha was very theologically minded, but her sister Mary, that's not the case with her. She's got more of an emphasis on worship, whereas Martha has more of an emphasis on theology. Okay. Now Jesus proclaims himself as the resurrection in verses 25 and 26. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Do you believe this? So Jesus Christ said he is the resurrection and the life. He is the resurrection because only Jesus has power over death. Only Jesus has power over death. In John 5, 24 to 29, he said the dead are going to hear his voice, and those who hear shall live, and they're going to rise from the dead. He is the life because only Jesus gives eternal life. John 14, 6, Jesus said, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." And he says that he gives his sheep eternal life and they shall never perish. In John 10, 28. So those who trust in Jesus for salvation, they might physically die. You know, then again, you might not if you're still alive when Jesus returns. But they might physically die, but they will spiritually live and never spiritually die. And so Jesus asked Martha if she believes. Now look by the way, at that in verse 26. He says, "And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Then he asked, do you believe this? If you're living right now and you believe in Jesus, and you genuinely believe in Jesus, Jesus said you shall never die. That's one of the reasons why I believe that a believer can't lose his salvation. A lot of people disagree with me on that, and there's a big debate on the issue, but I believe a true believer can't lose his salvation. But if a guy goes back into the world, it's just evidence that the guy really wasn't saved in the first place, because God will cause true believers to persevere and pray. By the way, I'm not going to break fellowship over that issue. There are a lot of godly brothers and sisters in the Lord, like people like Chuck Smith, who believe you can lose your salvation, and they're still serving the Lord in tremendous ways. So there's no reason to break fellowship over. Verse 27, Martha proclaims her belief in Jesus. She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world." And so Martha proclaims her belief in Christ. She calls him Lord, her master. It's kurios in the Greek. Write it on the board. Lord is kurios in the Greek. And it can just mean my master or my teacher, or it can mean that she's calling him God. So it's tough to say. But she also called him the Christ, Christos in the Greek. Or Messias, Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, the anointed one, the Redeemer that the nation of Israel had been waiting for, the one who would come and would rescue the nation of Israel, who was predicted about in the Old Testament. Now she also refers to him, though, as in verse 27, as the Son of God, which from a Jewish standpoint means God become a man. John 5:18, when Jesus was referring to himself as the Son of God, and his father in such a way that he's no one else's father, Jesus is claiming to be equal with God and God become a man. So she may have held to the deity of Christ even at that point. Very, very tough to say. If she understood the implications of her words, then she did hold to the deity of Christ. But she even said he's the Son of God who came into the world. She's saying he came from heaven. It sounds very much like this lady might have understood that Christ was claiming to be God. Now, he's got all these apostles, theologically minded apostles, and here are some of the ladies that were following Jesus were quicker to accept the deity of Christ than they were. So her theology was very sound. Unlike many believers today, she was grounded in her theology. You get a lot of believers today that just out to lunch, but she was grounded in her theology. Now, the resurrection on the last day that they were talking about, we don't have time to turn there, but in Daniel chapter 12, verses 1 to 2, it says that all will be raised, both believers and non-believers. Now, what Daniel doesn't tell you, there's actually a thousand-year gap where the unsaved get raised at the end. But all will be raised, but believers will be raised, according to 1 Corinthians 15, verses 50 to 58, to immortality. They'll be raised so that the bodies will never die again. 1 Thessalonians 4:13 to 18 tells us that the dead will rise first, but then in Revelation, when you look at Revelation 19, 11 to 16, and 24 to 6, it shows that there's two separate resurrections, the resurrection of believers at the second coming of Christ, and then the resurrection of the unsaved for the great white throne judgment a thousand years later after Jesus rules on earth for a thousand years.
What happens if someone gets saved during that thousand-year period of time?
I don't really have time to give a real good answer, but there's a possibility that you'll live the entire thousand years so long as you don't do something wrong that deserves you to be executed. In fact, Isaiah predicts that during that time, if somebody dies before they're 100 years old, they'll act like he must have committed some kind of crime because he died in his infancy. So it seems like... when the Lord comes back, it'll be like before the flood, and people are probably going to be living right up until the end of the millennium. But if they are a believer and they do die before time, they might just lay down in bed, die, and get their immortal body and twinkle of an eye and just go. I don't know. But the resurrection that's at the end of the millennium is for the unsaved.
Can you repeat what was the two resurrections?
The resurrection of the saved, Revelation 19:11 is. Revelation the second coming of Christ is in Revelation 19:11 to 16, and when you compare that with the second coming of Christ in other passages like Matthew 24, 29 to 31 and stuff like that, it talks about believers being caught up in the clouds with him. That's before the millennium, and then after the millennium the unsaved are raised from the dead and then judged at the great white throne judgment. But compassionate Lord is talked about in verses 28 to 37. Now we're going to see Jesus. He talks theology with Martha, and now he's going to share some compassion with Mary, who's more sensitive than her. Mary approaches Jesus in verses 28 to 22. Look at verse 28. And when she had said this, she went away and called Mary her sister, saying, secretly, the teacher is here and is calling for you. So Martha tells Mary that Jesus is coming. Martha called Jesus the teacher. And the thing was, though, that rabbis did not normally teach women. John 4:27, the apostles were shocked to see Jesus talking theology with a Samaritan woman. However, Jesus did. Jesus was willing to talk theology with women. It was important enough for him to talk theology with women. Verse 29, Mary immediately departs to meet Jesus. And when she heard it, she arose quickly and was coming to him. She dropped everything to be with Jesus. She did not hesitate when it came to following Jesus, unlike many of us. So Martha went out first to meet Jesus, but that didn't mean that Mary lagged behind because she didn't like Jesus. She just didn't know that he was coming yet. When she found out he was on the way, she ran out to meet him as well. Verse 30. And now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha met him. So he was still outside of Bethany at that point. Many of the Jews followed Mary, so a crowd is gathered in verse 31. The Jews then, who were with her in the house and consoling her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. So the Jews follow Mary. A crowd is gathering, and now we're going to see Mary where she normally is in the Gospels. Verse 32, and that's at Jesus' feet. Therefore, when Mary came where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Mary was always at Jesus' feet. You find her anointing Christ's feet in John chapter 12, verse 3, and Luke chapter 10, verse 39. In this situation, it showed her utter helplessness and her dependence on Jesus. Jesus, I can't cope with the situation. I can't get through. There's nothing I can do. I'm throwing myself at your feet. She drops to his feet and shows her dependence on Jesus. She makes the same basic statement as Martha had made. In verse 21, both sisters recognized Christ's power over sickness. Still, they needed to more clearly recognize Christ's power over death. So Jesus consoles Mary in verses 33 to 36. Look at verse 33. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled. So he sees Mary weeping, and he's deeply moved, angered, and troubled. The word there for troubled in the Greek paints a picture of like the snorting, the way a horse snorts. So it's like Jesus was so troubled due to the sorrow that death brings, that it's just a moan that comes out of him. Tremendous, tremendous emotion that's expressed here. God had created the world perfect, Genesis 1:31. But then God said, if you eat from the forbidden fruit, Genesis 2:15-17, man shall surely die. And then sure enough, in Genesis chapter 5, Adam died, Seth died, and the list goes on and on. Mankind dies, you live, and then you die. And Jesus sees her, and sees her sorrow from this. And then he thought back probably to the garden. And he thought, it didn't have to be this way. I didn't create man so that he would die. But because we sin, because we disobey God, because we do our own thing, we do die. And so Jesus is angered and troubled and feels sorrowful because of what death and the sadness that death and human suffering has brought to mankind. Verse 34, and said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. So Jesus asked for the location of Lazarus' tomb. And in verse 35, a memorization verse, you can memorize it right here and now, Jesus wept. Shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus associated himself with the sorrows of mankind. Our God is a God of compassion. Not like the God of Hinduism, Buddhism, or the New Age movement. That's pantheism, where God is the universe. God is an impersonal force. Our God is a God who can weep for us. Our God is a God who genuinely feels our pain. Now, we got a president who claims he feels our pain. Sometimes I doubt it. But we have a God who can feel our pain and experience our sorrow and associate himself with the sorrows of man, unlike the God of the New Age movement. Matthew 23, verse 37, he saw Jerusalem and he wept for Jerusalem because they rejected him, and he saw the turmoil that was going to bring upon them. But our God is a God who can weep for us and associate himself with our sorrows. We also should have Christ's compassion. And we're told that in Romans 12:15. But we also should have compassion for others and care for others. Now the Jews recognized Jesus' love for Lazarus when they saw this in verse 36. And so the Jews were saying, behold how he loved him. So they recognized his love for Lazarus. And then look at verse 37. But some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of him who was blind have kept this man also from dying? So even though they recognized that Jesus loved Lazarus, they accused Jesus of being late. If he would have been a little bit more diligent and a little bit more on time, this situation would have never come up. Now, lots of people know I got a tough schedule, but I'm late a lot of times. Do a Bible study a few minutes late here or there. Baptisms, I could be up to 30 minutes late for that. when Phil Fernandez is late, sometimes I got a good excuse, sometimes somebody need emergency counseling, sometimes I'm just late and it's my fault. But the thing is, God is never late. Jesus is God and God is never late. Sometimes we think he answers our prayers a little bit too late. No, God's timing is perfect. Sometimes we're just a little impatient, but God is never late. How Jesus dealt with Martha and Mary. When Jesus dealt with Martha, he encouraged her and he told her about his power. But when Jesus dealt with Mary, he showed her compassion and he wept with her. Now, the difference is Martha was more rationally inclined, so Jesus used theology. He talked theology with her. But with Mary, she was more emotional, so Jesus used compassion with her. And sometimes God leads us to counsel others with words. Other times he calls us to be silent. Sometimes people need to know how a good God can exist and at the same time evil exists. And so sometimes we've got to talk philosophy with them. Other people, when they lose a loved one, all they need is a hug. Some people want to hear philosophy and theology and us answering all the deepest questions, deepest intellectual questions they have. Other people, they just want a hug. A loved one of mine died, and I just need you to sit by me and to hug me and to love me and to let me know that you care. I don't feel God's love. Let God's love be channeled through you and into me. Each individual is different, and we have to learn to be sensitive to the needs of others. Now, Jesus proves his resurrection power in verses 38 to 57. Look at 38 to 40. Jesus therefore again, being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave and a stone lying against it. Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So now Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. The first day is when the messengers came to Jesus. The second and the third day is when Jesus waited. And the fourth day was the day that he traveled to Bethany. So now Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Many Jews believe that the soul remained near the body for 3 days after death. But since he had been dead 4 days, they would figure there's no hope of him being resurrected, of him being raised from the dead. Lazarus had a tomb. That meant that his family was extremely wealthy. Remember, when Jesus was buried in a tomb, it didn't mean that Jesus was wealthy. But it was Joseph of Arimathea, and he was wealthy. It was his tomb that he gave to Jesus. But Lazarus' family was wealthy. In fact, there's a passage in Luke which says that Lazarus, there was some woman who supported the ministry of Jesus, and the sisters of Lazarus were two of those ladies. But there were some wealthy ladies that were supporting the ministry of Jesus. But Martha's focus, she was focusing on the stench of human death. But Jesus' focus was on the glory of God. All she could think about was, well, you open that tomb and he's really going to stink. And Jesus thought, you open that tomb and God's going to be glorified. You open that tomb, I'm going to raise a man from the dead. The glory of God should be our focus. 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all for the glory of God. Whatever you're doing, do it to bring glory to God and to keep him in the spotlight. Jesus came to do God's will, verses 41 and 42. And so they removed the stone. Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank thee that thou heardest me, and I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people standing around, I said it, that they may believe that thou didst send me." So Jesus came to do God's will, and he wanted to show the Jews that he was not acting independently of God. Remember, John 6:38 said, "I came down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." John 5:21, he said, "I didn't come in my own name, but in my Father's name." Jesus wanted to show he was not acting independently of God the Father. In verses 43 and 44, he raises Lazarus from the dead. And when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And he who had died came forth bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." And so Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. He commands Lazarus to rise. You know, a real important guy a real authoritative guy can command the living and they'll obey him, but it takes real authority to command the dead and get obedience. But Jesus commands Lazarus to rise. Lazarus rises from the dead, and Jesus proves his power over death. Now it says Lazarus' hands and feet were tied and had a face cloth also. A lot of times we think of a mummy, that's off the wall. That's the way the Egyptians did it. The Shroud of Turin, whether or not it's the cloth of Christ is irrelevant, that kind of burial was the Jewish kind of burial. And I'll just draw a little chart here. What they did was they would tie the feet together and they would tie the hands together like that. Okay? Then they would put coins over the edge because when you die, sometimes you get nerve reactions and your body will lift up. And so they tie the hands together in the front by the lower by your lower stomach region. They'll tie the feet together, keep them from moving. Then they'll put coins over the eyes to keep the eyes from opening. And the face cloth actually is, it's like when you have a toothache, the way they used to draw that cloth, that was a towel wrapped around your head and tied up the top. That's what they would do to keep your mouth from opening. And then the grave clothes would finally consist in a shroud wrapped around you front and back, a big cloth around you front and back. That's the way when you picture Lazarus trying to come out of the tomb, picture him like that, not like an Egyptian mummy. They did not use the Egyptian mummy type burial. They have found multitudes of skeletons of Jews who had died during the time of Christ, and they're always in that shroud type. That is the normal Jewish burial. And we're running low on time. Let's look at verses 45 and 46, the response of the people. Verse 45, many therefore the Jews who had come to Mary and beheld what he had done believed in him. So many believed in Jesus. But others reported the miracle to the Pharisees. Verse 46, but some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Now the response of the Jewish religious leaders is found in verses 47 to 53. Look at verse 47. Therefore the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. So the chief priests got together with the Pharisees. The chief priests, they were of the Sadducee class. They controlled the temple rituals. They were the temple priests and all. They were wealthy. They had much political power and they were puppets of Rome. Whereas the Pharisees, they were the Jewish rabbis. They controlled the synagogues. The chief priests and the Sadducees controlled the temple. The Pharisees controlled the synagogues. They were the teachers of the law. They were in these little synagogues, which are a lot like our churches. They taught the Bible. They lacked the political power that the Sadducees had. They had their oral tradition where they added to the Old Testament laws. And they were often rivals with the Sadducees. They locked horns and disagreed on just about everything. However, they united in that they both hated Christ. The council here is probably a meeting of the Sanhedrin, the 70 Jewish elders, the leaders of the nation of Israel under Rome. They didn't have power over Rome. But they recognized Jesus' supernatural works, but they still rejected him. Look at verse 48. And if we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So they feared that the Romans would punish the Jews if they followed, if the Jews followed Christ, and then Christ rebelled against Rome, which the Old Testament predicted the Messiah would come and would defeat Rome when the Jews were in bondage. So now Caiaphas, the high priest, stands up in verses 49 to 53. By the way, they just found his tomb recently. Verses 49 to 53. But a certain one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all. Very diplomatic guy, and decides to make way. He says, you know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation should not perish. Now, this he did not say on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not only for, not for the nation only, but that he might also gather together into one the children of God who were scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. Now, Caiaphas was unsaved, okay? He was a Jewish high priest that year. His remains were recently found. He was a high priest from 18 A.D. to 36 A.D., and he said that Jesus must die or the nation of Israel will perish. Now God spoke through this evil man. This was an evil man. He was unsaved. But it still, God spoke through him, and it teaches Christ's substitutionary atonement. 1 Peter 2.24, 1 Peter 3.18, Jesus as the Lamb of God, John 1.29. Jesus died so that the nation of Israel wouldn't perish. Then John says you can apply this to the whole world. All of mankind does not have to perish because Jesus died as our substitute, took our punishment for us. Now Caiaphas did not realize his own words. He merely meant that they should kill Jesus so that Rome wouldn't punish the Jews. However, God, he didn't even realize the full implication of what he said. God was actually prophesying through him, even though he was a non-believer. God can raise up praise even from stones if he wanted to, the scriptures say. And so God can even use a non-believer. But from then on, the Jews planned to kill Jesus. It was like an organized plan now. It wasn't just some little few Pharisees here and there. It was the whole Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council. So they planned to kill Jesus. And so the Jewish leaders did go on to kill Jesus. Still, the Jewish nation still suffered at the hands of the Romans in 70 A.D. Verse 54, we're running way over time, but Jesus departs Bethany. Verse 54, Jesus therefore no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. And so Jesus departs Bethany, he no longer appeared publicly in the Jerusalem area, but he went to Ephraim, which is 15 miles north of Judea. Went to Ephraim, which is about 15 miles north of Judea. I can't even locate it on the map, running low on time here. But Jesus was willing to die according to the Father's timing, not the timing of his enemies. We're going to finish up John 11 in the next lecture. And we're going to have to really cut down on the brakes, so we might have to just keep moving here.